Oh, thank you very much. And I look forward to over time as all of these collaboration systems from all the vendors get better as they get based on WebRTC, and it gets easier to make this type of call work really well. I think that probably the first thing I wanted to touch on a little bit was just where we were thinking about WebRTC, where it was going in the business stuff, and then move into a little bit more of the technical details, and particularly around some of the identity stuff. Because I think you guys have been having some interesting discussions about WebRTC and identity and how that works and what's possible there. The really major things that were motivating us, and I think a lot of other people when we started all of this work, was to get it so that we could really make it easy to take communications and embed it into the type of applications where it was needed, easy to deploy it across lots of different types of devices, really upgrade the level of security that was possible. That was a really major focus on it. It's one of the things that on how this works I sort of most interested in talking about today. And then finally, it's interesting, I just lost the slides from, but not sure if you guys are still seeing them. Make it just sort of faster to be able to develop applications, make it really easy. Traditionally, it was pretty hard to build a complete voice and video application. And with WebRTC, we hoped it would make it really easy for lots of developers to be able to do it. And then finally, when we talk a lot about peer-to-peer, a lot of the web applications have traditionally needed to go, client-server. And this was a really big change in the web architecture, was to allow data to go directly between two things. So I think with that, what I want to do is skip forward to about slide, let's see, maybe 33? And it's labeled architecture or something. I'm not quite sure what numbers they'll show up on your slides as. Okay, I'm not hearing you guys now. I'm not hearing a thing. I could sort of see you on the video.
So you can hear us, if I'm not wrong.
Oh, yeah, now I can hear you.
We have muted, sorry. But we are here, so I'm listening to you, sorry.
No, that's all right then. So I can't tell what slide you're on. I think if your camera was slanted just slightly, let me just give up on the slides at this point, actually. So the sort of, the key parts of the WebRTC applications is to be able to set up all of the codecs and media at the bottom level, and then be able to set up the transports, get those through NATs and firewalls, negotiate what the type of media stack is, how we agree on what both sides are using, how to bind that to some identity, and then finally an API to program all of that. So from the sort of starting up, working through up through those layers, the key thing at the bottom was the codecs. So for audio, G711 is there for the backwards compatibility. Opus was there to give us a high quality wideband codec. Obviously, browsers can negotiate whatever codecs they support, but the minimum requirement is they have at least both of those, so that we have something to fall back to. So that's sort of our worst case scenario, is we fall back to those codecs, and over time they'll probably be better codecs. Now, with video, it was a little bit more complicated. That was one of the big things that was slowing down the standards for a long time, which was which video codecs to deal with. At this point, the general agreement in the standards groups, and it hasn't all been 100%, you know, finalized and written into finalized RFCs yet, but I expect this to happen, is that the browsers need to implement both VP8 and H.264 as minimal codecs. And this gives a fair amount of interoperability with existing video conferencing equipment, which is predominantly H.264. And it also works for a lot of people who don't believe they can use H.264 because they think of the due to patent issues largely, and so would prefer to use VP8. So the browsers end up doing both. Different applications that want to interoperate with those can choose either of those. So that's sort of what, from a standards point of view, the main thing that's happened on the video codecs from an update point of view. Moving up from that, sort of a layer in the how we get this data back and forth between things, it's actually sent with SRTP, so it's all encrypted. There's no option to not encrypt it, and this has been a real strong move, and I think the direction that a lot of this generation of work is going is, instead of having options to be encrypted or not encrypted or whatever, it's just secure all the time is the idea. And we think that that really helps make it actually easier to make it secure by not having as many options or as many negotiations and failures if there's just one way of doing it. So it's SRTP. The keying for that is DTLS. So this is going to allow both sides to set up a connection with each other with effectively a self-signed certificate. So each browser, you know, that it's a certificate doesn't really matter. The really important thing actually is both sides have an asymmetric public-private key pair. And they can use that to negotiate the DTLS session, then inside of that, negotiate all of the send the actual data, the audio and video and data channel information. Now, the fact that that is a self-signed certificate, or just a sort of effectively a raw public key, means you don't really know who you're talking to on the other side. And we're going to talk more about the identity work in a little bit, but that needs to be, that public key needs to be bound to some type of identity so you know who you're talking to. If all you know is you're talking to some random key, you might have a secure connection to the man in the middle. Okay, so the identity is a pretty key part of this. We'll come back to that in a bit. The actual negotiation through the NATs and firewalls, we use STUN to detect what the address outside of my firewall is. So STUN is a protocol where you send a packet out to a STUN server somewhere in the network, and it replies with what your packet, the address of where your packet looked like it came from, the IP address and port. And for many types of firewalls and NATs, you can use that IP and port, and if other people send traffic to you, it'll get forwarded back onto the actual device. So this allows two clients that are both behind different NATs to find out their public IP and port, and then communicate that to the other side and be able to use it. We find that that works in the somewhere, you know, depending on the sort of geographies, and different people have different measurements, you can hear numbers from that works from sort of the, you know, 85 to 95% of the time. It's a fairly high success rate, but nowhere near 100%. So to get that remaining percentage that doesn't work, data gets sent through a relay server of some sort. So this is where we go and use a turn server. And a turn server, just basically you connect to the turn server, you get a public port. It tells you an IP and port on that turn server. Other people can send packets to that IP and port. You tell the turn server who you're expecting those packets to be from. And if it receives packets from that person, it forwards them down onto you. And the receiving, the part where I said there that you have to tell the turn server where you're expecting the packets from, that was really a pretty important part for enterprises to be widely willing to allow turn through their firewalls. Is it's not a way to run a generalized server on the internet. It can't just connect. It won't accept connections from anywhere and then have them come to you. You have to be able to tell the turn server who's connecting to you. So that helps mitigate the issues of just using it as a general server. Now, ICE is a technique to take all of these things and detect which one might work. So we have lots of ways that it might work for packets to go between us, just sending directly between the IP addresses, using these STUN approaches, or in a worst case, a turn approach. And STUN is an idea where both sides effectively order all of the possible ways they might be able to connect to each other. Then they try them by just sending packets back and forth to each other. They use Stun actually to detect connectivity, but it's just basically send a ping and see if you get a pong back. And then whichever one works best, they choose. And so that's basically the ICE thing. So that's the essence of how WebRTC is trying to set up those types of channels. Now, all of the media needs to be negotiated. Both sides need to know what codecs the other one supports and then select the best out of those possibilities. There's the IP ports, all of those. There's a couple ways you could go about this, and the standards groups have been looking at different ones long ago. And the one that they selected to do first was SDP. And SDP is basically, it's used by all SIP devices. It's used in some other protocols as well. It's basically an idea where one side sends an offer of all the things that it's capable of receiving and what it wants to transmit. The other side sends back an answer, and it's in this session description protocol language, which describes its capabilities. Now, the key thing about it is a paired offer answer. It's not a declarative statement. It's not, here's what I'm going to do, and I'm doing it. It's, here's the range of possible things I can do in the offer, and then in the answer, some subset of those is selected. An alternative way of doing this was, before I talk about alternative ways, back up for a second. That forces the browser to implement the whole negotiation procedure. And the JavaScript has a pretty easy time of it. It results in not many lines of JavaScript to write a WebRTC application, because you just get an offer from the browser, you send it to the other side, and you get the answer back, and you put it back in. An alternative way to do this that was discussed, and at the time it was called a low-level API, I think we're moving to the term direct API now as a more useful way of describing it, was instead all the negotiation is implemented in the JavaScript. So the JavaScript would have detailed control of exactly what it wanted to do to the media stack. Like, you should be sending, it can find out what codecs the media stack can support, but it would also say, okay, I want you to be receiving this codec on this port with these types of parameters and transmitting exactly like this. And you push all the negotiation up into something you implement in JavaScript, and you provide a fine-grained control of what's going on at the JavaScript API layer. So this sort of direct API approach, a few years ago, we decided to go with the SDP approach as a first thing, and then later when that was done, we would go with, we'd do a second API, we'd extend the API to have a direct API as well. That's starting to happen right now. Some of you have probably seen the ORTC work that Hook Flash and Microsoft have been working on. That's a proposal for a direct API, and I believe that large parts of that API will come into the WebRTC 1.0 API and will become a WebRTC 1.1 API. So that's one of the things that's going on with ORTC right now in that work. Now, so that's sort of the negotiation layer. Today it's SDP-based. In the future, we think it'll continue to have the SDP-based, obviously, but we think we'll also extend it for the direct API approach. Some applications might want to use the direct API approach, where they take responsibility for all the negotiation. Some other ones just want to get the best audio video they can, and they'll just use the browser's negotiation. So moving one more layer up on this stuff gets us to the identity work. And flipping through my own slides here to remember this. If you're following along with slides, this would be slide 55. The issue on the web right now today is identity is a rapidly changing thing. We're seeing lots of different things. I mean, Facebook Connect is a very widely deployed identity system. Similarly with Google things. We see lots of web applications moving to OAuth 2. From a Cisco point of view, we probably think that OAuth 2 is, and particularly the OpenID Connect sort of version of it, is likely to be one of the most prevalent things that's widely deployed on the web's side. There's tons of deployment of SAML as well. It's a very useful environment for a bunch of things. And then there's various sort of proprietary things and different tokens. It's a very dynamic, changing place in identity over the next 5 years. We'd like to see move to a world where enterprises that own their own namespace were also responsible for their name servers. So we like the idea, if you're some company, foo.com, and you have a user, maybe it's Cullen at foo.com. I mean, who really controls that name, right? I mean, the people that own foo.com could provide that name, Cullen, to any different person. They control that namespace to a certain degree, and they're the best people to make assertions about it. So we like the idea that the domain name owner or the namespace owner would run an identity server that could vouch for and make statements about the identity of users in that domain. It's sort of their namespace. The idea of having some huge global namespace, like sort of the Facebook one, is easy right now, but it requires everybody to have that type of Facebook account, and it has a lot of privacy implications. It doesn't federate as well. We're less keen on those, but we recognize that predominantly that's what's winning on the internet today, is effectively Facebook or Google as the login services. And maybe there's LinkedIn or maybe there's Twitter, a very small number of major identity providers. We'd rather see a much more federated approach. So when we're designing WebRTC, the problem was it wasn't like we could choose one of the existing identity systems and just pick that as, oh yeah, we're going to use that one, because they're changing too quickly. So what we wanted to do was instead choose a framework that allowed us to plug in a wide range of different identity systems. So the basic idea is that the browser will be able to run some JavaScript which can get a signed assertion of some form. That might be an OAuth token, it might be a SAML token, it might be a completely different thing, that binds whatever you believe the username is the user's trying to use to the public key that we used for our DTLS connection and that all the media is encrypted with. And the way that we do that is the browser would download some JavaScript that knew how to interact with whatever identity service was being used by that system. And the browser would ask that JavaScript to run and go and get one of these tokens effectively. We would pass that token along, or assertion, I guess would be a better phrase, along to the far side. And on the browser on the far side, similarly, would be able to run some JavaScript to validate that token. Now, some of the assertions may just be self-validating. They may be, signed with a well-known something or other so that you don't have to contact anything. Some of them may be much more of a token type of form where you have to contact some server to find out whether it's a valid thing or not. So the OAuth2 model is more along those lines. So the basic call flow with this is the user logs on to whatever identity server they use. If that's an enterprise system that deals with SAML, this would be normal login flow. They'd use whatever their credentials they had with that enterprise to authenticate to the identity server. The identity server would be willing to hand them SAML assertions. So next, when the browser wants to make a call, it takes some key information, but mostly the private key associated with the call. The other key information is just to make sure it's bound to the right call. And it gets an assertion from the identity provider, which binds the DTLS fingerprint of the certificate to the identity that they're trying to use for the system. So this might be an assertion that bound fluffy@cisco.com to whatever the fingerprint of the self-signed certificate that I'm going to use to make this call. From that happens in one set of JavaScript, which is not the same JavaScript as the application. That's the identity provider JavaScript, and the browser is communicating back and forth with that. The browser then takes that and hands that assertion to the JavaScript that's running the calling application that's going to actually make the phone call. This makes it call, this passes it with the rest of the STP signaling along to the other side. The other side passes that into the browser. The browser then can message that over to another set of identity JavaScript, which can verify that. Now, there's a couple interesting properties about this whole system. One is that the calling side and the caller and the callee don't even have to use the same identity service. One of them might be using completely different protocols. One might be using Auth2 and one might be using SAML. Now, they would have to be able to run the enough of the code to validate the other's ones, but the key point here is that the identity services that used by both sides don't have to be the same. They can use whatever identity service they want to represent their identity, but they do have to be able to validate and check whatever identity service the other side's using. The other thing that's interesting about this is we've actually made it so that the media can be tied to an identity. So you could say, I am willing to send my media to someone that has this particular identity validated through the browser, but not any other person, and that the actual JavaScript doesn't have access to it. So one of the things that we're, you know, that Cisco's really trying to move to, and I think many other people, or some other people, not many other people, in building video conferencing systems is things like WebEx, like Hangouts, Spark is our latest thing. Particularly with Spark, what we're trying to do is make it so that the conferencing provider, the Spark in this case, doesn't actually have access to the media. We don't need access to the media. We need to know who's talking to who and how to connect each other up, but we don't need access to the media. And so this type of model allows the peer, the identities to start to be bound in a much stronger way, where the end users run their own identity service. They can assert that. They can send the media encrypted only to the far end other user. But the person in the middle that's operating this conferencing service doesn't actually have access to the media. It just has access to move the packets around to the right people. So I think that those were some of the, you know, the main key things that I was hoping to get to talk to you guys about. I think with this, I'd like to try and, you know, unmute the room here and see if there are other questions or areas or things that we should talk about.
So my first question is you mentioned about identity and only the identity attribute is in the current WebRTC standard. Why not more than one attribute is sent with the identity to the other part to make a more sophisticated authentication? So make a more sophisticated decision to accept the call or not. So the standard is mentioning that it could contain, but the current implementation, what I saw in the Firefox, it's only implementing that sending the identity attribute. So the fluffy at cisco.com or so only a user part and domain part, no other plus attributes like a group or other entitlements and so on.
So that may be a bit of a limitation. So first of all, I should back up and say, you know, this is one of the most unspecified part of the spec where a bunch of work's needed. It'd be great to get feedback on how to do that more. Firefox implementation is the one that's farthest along right now, but it's far from complete. And certainly we would want to be able to pass along the actual assertion could have if we were using attribute certificates or something else like that, it should be able to contain a large opaque blob of data that contained whatever data made, you know, whatever attributes and things made sense going across. As far as the actual identity, it should not be bound to just username at domain. It should be able to have a sort of generic string in there. I mean, some people, for example, very much want to use, you know, PSTN style cell numbers as the identities that are being asserted against. But it really should take basically any string on that type of idea. So if we're not seeing that, that's probably more of a bug in Firefox, and we should probably go talk to those guys and get it fixed up. Does that make sense?
Yes. Thank you very much. I don't know what other questions do we have in the room or remotely. I have many questions, but I don't want to, if the other says. Okay, if not, then this, my second question is, what is your thinking about ORTC and ORTC implementation, and will Cisco use the new ORTC standard, and if Microsoft will have in the Internet Explorer, or what are your plans?
I would just be on PG.
So the ORTC is definitely a pretty complicated topic right now. I don't think anybody can say that 100% they know what will happen here. So take this as my best guess of what will happen, okay? The idea of the API that ORTC brings forward, this direct API, people have been very keen on that type of API since day one. We just didn't, we had to decide which one we did first. Did we do the high-level API or the low-level API first? We decided to do the high-level SDP negotiation API first and then add the low-level API. So I think that people want to bring that type of API and something very close to ORTC. ORTC is far from done and has lots of issues. There's things you can't do with it yet. It needs changes. But I think people want to bring that type of thing into WebRTC as WebRTC 1.1. So my guess is that's what will happen. Now, one of the topics that comes up at times is Microsoft has suggested they do not want to implement SDP at all, ever, and they would like to deprecate the SDP-based API in WebRTC 1.0 and just have the direct API. I think this is stark raving mad and will never happen. People are not going to deprecate that out. It's way too useful in API. It has a lot of functionality that's not available in the other API, including the ability as the browsers just get more stuff in them for new applications to automatically start, or for applications start taking advantage of that. So, for example, if I wrote an application that was a video conferencing system on a website and suddenly some new codecs with some new capabilities or a new error correction system got implemented in the browsers, and both your browser and my browser had that, we should just be able to take advantage of that with no change of the existing application. That's not really the way ORTC works. It's much more it has to understand, because it has to implement the negotiation of that new feature, so the application has to understand it. So I do not believe that the WebRTC 1.1 will deprecate the SDP work in 1.0, and I think that people will move away from that. Where you see this coming out right now is in the chartering language. We're trying to recharter the WebRTC working group and bring that forward. So this brings around the question of when will various browsers implement all of that stuff? I would imagine Chrome and Firefox over time would, as that's got standardized and written, they would implement a direct API control surface. I think they've always intended to do that type of API at some point in time. They certainly don't intend to deprecate any of the other stuff. When we get to Apple and Safari, Apple follows this work closely and provides suggestions here and there. But they maintain strict radio silence on if or when they might ever implement this. My guess is it would not be that difficult for them to implement WebRTC. They have lots of code to work from and things. Largely implementing WebRTC in a browser is taking a soft phone and embedding it in a browser. So they have great soft phones with things like FaceTime and stuff like that. They have all the technology they need to embed it in. It's well within their skill set. So they could easily do it if they wanted. I don't know what their plans will be. Now, Microsoft has made it very clear. So they've got IE and they have Edge. My understanding is that they have no intention of putting large chunks of new functionality in IE at all, that they're just sort of capping and ending that, and all new work would go into Edge. So I don't believe that WebRTC is very likely to show up in IE directly ever, really. I mean, people could make a plugin perhaps that did that or something like that, that they could be shipped. I mean, maybe I'll be surprised, but I think that Microsoft's focus is on their new stuff, Edge. And look, if the Edge stuff doesn't go very well, that plan may change and they may go back to backporting things into IE. I mean, you know, it's very difficult for any company to make a transition from one generation of technology to the next. That's what they're trying to do here. So if that goes poorly, then all bets are off. But on Edge, I think that they intend to start doing some of the ORTC stuff and getting in more and bits and pieces of that in there. But I haven't heard any dates or plans for having a full WebRTC implementation at all. So I think there's still a fair ways to go there. But I think my expectation and understanding is that they do want to do that. Now, the exact details of what that is gets sort of complicated because sometimes they're saying, yes, we're going to do a WebRTC implementation, including whatever the standard requires, which would require SDP. Other times they're saying, well, no, we're not going to do the SDP stuff. Other times they're saying, well, we're just going to do the ORTC part of it. It's a pretty inconsistent set of messages, and it's hard to get. My bet over time is they will not want to be the browser that, you know, that they'll want to have a WebRTC implementation in their browsers, and it'll be the main thing. From a Cisco point of view, we like a product like WebEx. Obviously, we've got a mix of browsers across the board, and the thing that we see is, we see all the browsers trying to move away from plugins. So WebEx can no longer use plugins as much to do this, and we want to move to using WebRTC as a way to not need a plugin. So that's great with Chrome and Firefox, no problem, we're getting what we need. The problem with Microsoft is, basically Edge has, you know, almost no market share. It's all, you know, it's all IE is what the large enterprises use. The enterprises that were very progressive and forward looking and would be likely to switch to Edge had already switched to Chrome or Firefox. So we worry about that from a point of view of what's going to happen here with IE, because the issue isn't Microsoft. The issue is IE as a browser. Is it going to support WebRTC? I mean, whether this new browser that has small market share and is slowly moving up called Edge supports it or not, that's great, but that's not our problem. What IE does is our problem. So it's still a difficult problem in this space. We don't really know what we're going to do. I realize that was a really long answer, but it's a complicated topic.
My next question is about browser and feature fragmentation and feature parities. As you mentioned that every browser has different implementation level of the WebRTC standard. As we saw in identity, for example, Chrome do not have anything, as far as I know, about identity implemented. Firefox implemented, but not still under development, not mature yet, the code. So what do you think about this barrier? So I see it as a problem.
Yeah. I agree. But recognize that all of this stuff is just developed in parallel, and the standards are far from done here. I mean, I generally don't expect the browsers to have the stuff fully implemented until, you know, maybe a year. I'm just making a number up off the top of my head after the standards are finished. I hope that the standards finish by the end of this year. Identity was one of the most complicated and the last parts of the standard being done. So it's still, you know, I view that part of the standard as still, 70% done. And the browser Firefox's implementation of it, 40% done. I'm, again, just making up sort of random numbers, but you get the idea. It's still a ways from done. So I think we need to finish the specifications. And then we need to follow through and get the major functionality working in the browsers, and then follow through and clean up the small bugs and little corner cases that come up. Now, one thing I can say about this, though, is that both the Firefox and Chrome team understand. I mean, they want applications written that run on one browser to work just the same on the other browser. They're both very keen on that. And they're both working real hard to, anytime there's a difference, go, wow, why did we do different things? What is the difference? Let's go clarify the spec so it's clear on which one's the right way to do it, and then go and implement it. So I think we will get that, but just realize that this WebRTC spec, even though you can get stuff done with it today, with the current implementations, it's got a long way. So I think we're a fair amount of time out before we resolve those, but I think they will resolve. Actually, I should just add one more thing too, which is, it's really great if people like you that are discovering these and seeing these problems, send mail to the list, let people know. I mean, Martin Thompson at Firefox is the guy doing that implementation. He'd be glad to hear from you on like what's missing or what's needed. And you know, get that feedback. We need people who are using this stuff to give feedback of what's working, what's not working, what they need, what should be high priority, all of that.
Excellent. I hear that Cisco Communication Services is supporting XAML-based federated authentication, and we, the Higher Education and Research Education Networks, also have a very big XAML-based federation, a worldwide federation. And we are very keen to integrate this to identity with WebRTC identity, and we look forward to what Cisco will implement in this part with WebRTC identity and Cisco communication XAML thing. So if you could speak anything about is this on your roadmap?
Sure.
And you are investigating this also?
Okay, yeah, and so I have to often be careful about, you know, pre-announcing what Cisco is going to do or not do here. So I'm going to sort of focus on one product, which I think is the most interesting one from this collaboration point of view, which is the Spark stuff. So Spark has a pretty, its identity system, the basic underlying technology in Spark is it goes to an enterprise identity server. It gets a SAML type of assertion. It uses that through to its own internal identity server to move it to an OAuth token, OAuth2 tokens, which it then uses across all of its internal things. And that's part of because we wanted to use OAuth2. It was a good model for internally what we're trying to do across all of the services that, you know, Spark is a bunch of microservices all put together, and those services use OAuth tokens, OAuth2 tokens to communicate with each other. But the identity service that Spark uses, the way it issues an OAuth2 token is by using a SAML token. And the way we get the SAML token is by going to a common enterprise identity server, and the user authenticates using over a web page login to get whatever the token is there. So we see across a lot of customers exactly the type of things you're talking about. People are widely using SAML for that type of environment, and that's at least one of the major services we can expect to see. So we need to be able to leverage that. The universities and research institutions have really been, has always led the edge in federated identity, as far as I can tell, in actual real deployments of federated identity that really work. And we'd love to be working with people on prototyping some of the stuff, seeing how this would work. Right now, Spark is at a stage where really we're mostly running the identity service and adding users there, and we haven't gotten out to fully federate across with other companies. We've done it with a few. And we want to move it more, but it's an area where we know where we want to go, but the code still, there's still lots of code that needs to be done to get that all going. And clearly in the WebRTC context is with Spark, it uses WebRTC for the web implementation of it. So does that answer the question?
Yes, it was. And I have one last question. We heard today from Video that they are implementing the VP9 codec, the scalable video codec. So also a question about Cisco opinion about the 265 and the VP9 codec. But we know that Cisco opened the open H64 codec and give the possibility to use in Firefox and any other browser for free, or to use the binary clock codec. So what are your plans in the scalable video codecs or the SVC, VS, simulcasting? So,
right. So, I mean, let me separate a couple different things here. From the actual codecs, like, I mean, we just want to see good, high quality codecs widely implemented and get out there. We don't care what they are. We're trying to enable that and make it feasible. And obviously IPR is one of the major stumbling blocks of doing that. Google's position is things like VP9 are royalty free. Many other companies like Nokia assert that they have IPR on it and they're unwilling to license it. So for some people think that they can use VP9 for free. Some people think they can't use it at all. Now, when we move to 264, everybody agrees it's not that there's patents on it, and it's pretty understood what the licensing cost is, and we've been doing this whole OpenH264 thing to try and make sure that we can deliver that so that lots of people can use it and we pay the royalties for them. With 260, so that's the previous generation, really, VP8 264 codecs. Now, when we start talking about VP9 or 10 and H265, we don't know whether we'd be, I mean, the 265 licensing pool is not complete in any way whatsoever yet. So we don't know whether we'd be able to do a similar thing with 265. We'd certainly consider it if we could. We don't know what the patent status is with VP9, VP10. We suspect that, you know, since those are so heavily based on the prior things, it's probably worse than the situation for VP8. It just adds more patents. So we're really not sure what will happen with any of that. Now, that's on the underlying base codecs. So I would say from Cisco's point of view, we are shipping 265 across a large portion of our portfolio and we'll continue doing that. If the patent issues resolved and cleared up around the VPX series of codecs, we'd be thrilled and happy, and we'd consider adding them in. But with the current patent situation, we're basically in the camp that we think there's IPR on it, so we don't ship it because we can't license the IPR. Now a different issue is the scalable and simulcast issue. So with any video codec, you can generally define a scalable version of it as well. And when I say scalable, I really mean that, you know, the bits that you coded in a low-res version of it, you can largely use to reduce the number of bits you need in the high-res version of it. And so that's, video has a lot of IPR in that space. The base VP9 standards does not have, you know, the stuff that Google claims is IPR-free or royalty-free. May or may not include that. It's complicated. It's a different thing. So then there's what I call simulcast. And what I mean by simulcast is you send a low-level version of the stream or a low-res version of the stream, and you send a high-res version of the stream. And if you totally lost the low-res version, you can still decode the high-res version. It's not like you use the bits in the low-res version to reduce the number of bits you need to send in the high-res version. And this might be both temporal frame rates, lower and higher frame rates, as well as resolution, but you get the basic idea. Now, our measurements and mucking around with simulcast is the bit rate saving, particularly after you added substantial error correction so that if you lose some of the low-res bits, you don't trash your high-res stream, that the actual bit rate savings of SVC versus simulcast were very minimal. And it was a huge pain and a huge amount of IPR. So we're not really very keen on that type of SVC. We just prefer the simulcast approach. Seems to work really just a lot easier, have a lot less problems, and almost the same, you know, very close to the same bit rates. I mean, obviously SVC does save a bit, but what it turns out as is the low-res stream is such a drop in the bucket compared to the high-res stream that it doesn't really matter much, particularly when you start talking about real networks and what you have to do with error correction and the burstiness of the networks. I mean, if I have a network that is capable of, I mean, I guess the thing what I'm saying is, a 10% increase in bandwidth seldom changes whether if a actual call is going to work across the internet or not. Right? It's just far more, the internet's itself more variable than that, so this just gets lost in the noise. So we're not really actually very keen on the very classic SVC of the type that video really has a lot of energy into. There are some SVCs that really reduce to simulcast where the bits don't come in there. We're fine with those, but I'd probably call those simulcast, not SVC, and avoid the IPR issues. So that's where we're going on it is lots of simulcast support. It's obviously really useful with conferences to send low-res and high-res versions and then have the switching video conference just not have to retranscode the video. We're trying to move away from centralized MCUs that have to decode and recode video. And it's not so much the computation cost, that's part of it, but it's the security cost. We want to move to a situation where the MCU did not have access to decrypt the video. And that means if it needs to deliver low-res versions to some people and high-res versions to other people, it needs to receive both of those from the sender. And that, you know, so that's where we're really moving on the simulcast space. The browsers right now for WebRTC don't really particularly support simulcast and SVC all that well, but it's definitely an intention to add that. We've been working with both Firefox and Chrome on adding that. I think we'll see that coming over time, though. In fact, fairly high priority. And there's bits of it's like if you sort of hack apart how Google Hangouts works, it's already using some of the simulcast stuff. It's just not sort of in a standardized way or documented way. And they intend to move that through to a documented way and get that all standards. So as the standards evolved, both Spark, Firefox's Hello, and Google Hangouts, I expect to see all of them move to that.
Hey, this is Peter from Géant. Just one last question, which is not really technical. I apologize for that. I'm just wondering how do you position your WebRTC stuff compared to your traditional telepresence VC type of product line. So you plan to maintain some sort of interoperability or WebRTC support across all the VC related products across Cisco, or you just think that, you know, the future just started today and you gradually leave the past behind and put more efforts into the WebRTC direction?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're very much, there'll be interoperability across that. We view that, you know, the telepresence or any video conferencing experience, be it telepresence or not, we want to deliver that across a lot of different devices and environments. And one of them is in web browsers. And so WebRTC is what we use to deliver it in web browsers. And we want to make sure that that's compatible with all the other ways that we're delivering it. So whether we're delivering it on an iPad or whether we're delivering it on a three-screen telepresence system, you know, our view is all of that will go forward in a very strong way. And, you know, the quality of video that is achievable on the very best WebRTC implementations, I think if you put that side by side with, you know, a high-end dedicated telepresence system, it's today not even close. But over time, we want to see those converge and come together and be the same protocols. So that's a large part why we've participated in WebRTC, actually, is that we thought it was really important for WebRTC to be interoperable with the existing deployed systems. And the existing deployed systems are all the video conferencing systems that exist out there, but it's also like even the PSTN. And, you know, Skype exists as a company because it could connect to the PSTN. That's where all the revenue came from, basically, right? And when we look at the examples of communication systems that really took off and became a large ecosystem with tons of users, they were all compatible with what comes before. So we want to make sure that all the stuff that is deployed today, the SIP-based video conferencing systems, interoperates fairly well. And, you know, going forward, we don't, you know, like the WebRTC spec refers to this stuff as legacy, but that's just an indication of the protocols came from before, not that there isn't going to be continued development on it. So Cisco's going to continue developing, you know, new telepresence systems, new other things. And yeah, we want them to be compatible with our communication systems, be they Spark, WebEx, whatever, running in a browser. And those are going to be WebRTC based. So that's very much the direction we see it going forward. And we know some other vendors have a different view of it. I mean, Microsoft would be perfectly happy to see everything that was shipped before just not work and be replaced with something new. You know, I think that the large portion of the vendors, Avaya, Polycom, are pretty much on the same page as us.
So you're saying that the WebEx stuff, for instance, will converge more into the WebRTC direction, so you don't need another plugin to reinstall, but the native browser, is this the direction?
Yeah. Exactly. And in fact, some versions of WebEx, depending on if you have the latest version of WebEx deployed right now, if you go to the main page to launch a conference, there's a link right below it that says, you know, launch a WebRTC beta, launch a whatever. So it's already in sort of public beta WebEx based on WebRTC. And it look, it's lacking. There's many things that it doesn't have the full features of WebEx yet today. But that's definitely the direction that WebEx is going. That Spark is already all WebRTC based. You know, so that's the direction that those things are going, and it's a good technology that we want to take advantage of.
So, thank you very much. And one last question: could you share with us the public part of your presentation, so we could put the public part of your presentation onto your web page?
I definitely will. What I'll do is I'll send over a set of slides to the organizers and make sure that you guys can get it out to everyone else with it. It's a thick set of slides, if not a good set of slides. And I think there's some useful stuff in there. I'm sorry we couldn't really present them today, but I think this was a good discussion anyway. So thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much for and give applause to Kiran. I'm very happy that such talented people could be invited in such meetings, and I'm very thankful to Norbert also to make it available for us.